Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, it's already the 21st, which means we better say Happy Holidays, Merry Christmas.
Well, we'll have time to squeeze it in again next week, but the good news is that it's going to be the first day of winter, so we start going down.
Oh, wow.
This first day of winter is either today or tomorrow, depending on how you read the planetary calendar.
Well, but you know what? I mean, our son's birthday is the 23rd.
Right. Yeah. Happy birthday, Adam. While we're about it.
And starting then, the days start getting longer again, which makes me happy.
That's very good. That's very good. Well, anyway, we
have a great show.
What are we up to today? We have a good show.
We have a great show.
We always have a good show.
Very talented women. Not only are they talented, but they're also articulate, which means you're going to have something nice and interesting and informative to listen to.
And they have, and they have great stories too.
And they have wonderful stories. And first up is a woman chef that I just met who is dynamite. And her name is Courtney Burns, and she's with Bar Tartine. And well, she'll tell us about her story. And
Let's hear it then.
An amazing book. I think everybody should get it. Okay. I was saying to Courtney Burns before coming on air that I was absolutely startled by the originality of her cookbook, Bar Tartine, which she wrote with Nicholas Bala. Courtney, you are to be congratulated, and I am totally in awe of the talent and creativity that you have.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so kind, and thanks for having me on with you today.
Now, you have a history, mainly your background, your roots are in Hungary, well, Nicholas is in Hungary, and also yours would be in Eastern Europe as well, right? Russian and Lithuanian and...
Yes, correct. My mother's side is all Russian, Lithuanian, and Polish. My dad, Irish, but not so much of the food scene in our house is coming from that side.
Oh, okay. Actually, they have a very good food scene there right now.
They sure do.
Yeah.
But it didn't used to be like
Never
that.
Never used to be like that.
No, the early 1900s weren't necessarily. It wasn't known for the food.
Now, the other part of your history is where you've traveled and lived and the food you've experienced. Could you give our listeners some idea of all those influences?
Sure. From my end, when I was in college, I moved out to Southern Asia, and I was living in Nepal and India, and I traveled through Mongolia and Thailand, and the spices really had a big impact on the foods I wanted to eat, the flavors that I loved, and kind of these full-flavored, spicy, sour, kind of nuanced foods were something that I began to crave. And then also this deep love and affinity for Japanese cuisine, Japanese culture, and all of that. Nick also, his father actually now lives in Japan, used to live in Hungary, so a lot of his food influences have come from following his dad from place to place where he lives.
You know, what did his dad do? He cooked, actually, too, huh?
He's a wonderful cook, but he cooks out of love for food, but necessity and, you know, to sate the body and the mind. But he teaches English. He's also a poet. He wrote the poem at the beginning of the book.
So Phil Bala, then, is the father, the poet.
Correct.
Oh, great. Yeah, that was a lovely poem. He's quite good.
He's quite good.
Yeah. Anyhow, tell us a little bit of background information about Bar Tartine and its relationship to Tartine Bakery.
So Tartine Bakery opened more than 10 years ago in the Mission District in San Francisco, and about 2 or 3 years after they opened, someone approached Chad and Liz, Chad Robertson and Liz Pruitt, and said, you know, there's a restaurant space on Valencia. The Mission was still kind of underdeveloped as far as the culinary scene went in San Francisco, and so they were asked to open a restaurant here and create a space where people could come and dine, neighborhood people could come and dine. And so they did that. Originally it was a wine bar, quote-unquote, with kind of, you know, California bistro cuisine, very satisfying burgers, you know, things of that nature, bone marrow. And it was really a creative space, and Chad and Liz are really good at working with people and having a space for them to really hone in on it, what it is they want to do in the moment. And so there's been a lot of chefs that have rotated through here, and not in any sort of way that speaks negatively on the space. It's just one of those spaces that has kind of a constant rotation of, you know, creative minds. And that was the past. And then we've been here the longest. So in February of 2011, Nick took over the kitchen at Bar Tartine after a long relationship that he had had at Chad eating at one of his Japanese restaurants for many years. And they both decided that they wanted to kind of get more in touch with both Nick's Hungarian roots and the grains that are being grown and had been grown all over Central and Eastern Europe. So they took a couple trips over there and started forging ahead on the reconcepting of Bar Tartine.
Now what do you do? You haven't said anything about you yet.
Oh,
what
listen.
Do I do?
And then, what do you do?
I know what she does because Kevin Sousa says she's a kick-ass chef.
Yeah, but
Nick and I co-chef the restaurant now.
Okay, got it.
But this other gentleman, it was reconcepted. Nick and I are partners in life and in work, and we already had a relationship.
Okay.
I was doing other things. I had left restaurants for a minute and was helping some friends with some business things that they were doing, bringing some products to market, doing a lot of private chefing, just kind of taking a break from restaurants. And then when Nick took over here, he would call me to come in and make cheese or butcher a goat or come make salami. And I just kind of never left. And then we decided that we would work collaboratively together in
Got
this
it.
Space.
Somebody else owns the restaurant, this other gentleman.
Yeah, Chad and Liz own the restaurant.
Okay. Chad and Liz, okay. I remember walking past Bar Tartine one day when we were in the Mission District. There are a couple of guys who have, they have two restaurants in the Mission District. We went to both of them. I can't remember their names. One sort of sounds like pig. There's a sort of a barbecue connection in there. And then the other one's slightly different. And I'm pretty sure we walked past Bar Tartine as we were going.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's kind of right on the main drag here.
Yeah, but the next time we're there, we're going into Bar Tartine.
Yes, come in next time. Exactly. Let us feed you.
Yeah, oh, listen. You say your high priority is deliciousness. That's wonderful to hear.
We feel like, you know, this restaurant is our home. It's where we spend more time than we spend at home, which means that we have to also eat here, which means that we want to create food that not only intrigues our diners and keeps them interested and happy, but we ultimately want them to feel like they're having a satisfying meal. We don't want to have them have to think too hard. It's not overly conceptual food. And today, it needs to be delicious, and from there we can play. If it's not delicious to begin with, it's never going to be delicious. We can't make it greater than the sum of its parts. So we start with delicious ingredients. We strive to layer in flavor so that we can make it hopefully even more delicious. And then in the end, if it satisfies someone to eat it, and it hopefully has some reference in reality and nostalgia and memory and all of those things, it's not too far out there that it has no basis in any of that, then we feel like we've created a successful dish.
Now, it's intriguing. The first part of the book, and it's a very large part of the book, is all about how you make the ingredients of deliciousness. But the thing that caught me most, and the thing that's going to surprise, and I think people are going to enjoy when they start to get into the recipe part of it, is I noticed that you said Bar Tartine doesn't have main courses. You have sharing plates, but you don't actually have a sort of a conventional way of putting a main meal on the table.
We don't necessarily, and that really comes from the way that we were raised and the way that we both grew up eating, which was a bunch of different things on the table to enjoy. And our favorite meals are smorgasbord meals, basically. All sorts of things on the table, lots of different flavors that do work together and meld well, but also create an experience like you're almost in someone's home. It's not very often that we go and have, super formal meals in people's homes where everything's coursed out and we're cleared and all of that. And so we really want to recreate this comfortable environment where people can kind of sit, relax. There's a lot of food on the table. Everyone's going to get fed. No one has to grab quickly. If they need more, we have it. And that's really the energy that we want out there. And that creates community at a table. And so that's important to us.
Now, you've divided your book into two parts, and the first part is what Peter was talking about, is that it's a large segment on your larder, a very ambitious larder, and involves a lot of techniques. The second, then, section is the recipes themselves. What's interesting, and I think will be very useful to readers, is that as you're going over the various ingredients in your larder, you refer to the recipes that use that particular ingredient. And then when you're doing the recipes, you refer back to the item in the Lord or and how to make it. Did you, I mean, this is what I took from it. Isn't that true?
Yeah, no, that's exactly how it works. Right. The technique section, so we have techniques and recipes. The first 190 pages are techniques. They're things that we make in-house. I mean, one of the main things that we really focus on here is making things, partially just because we're curious and we want to know how things are made, and also because the larder that we create, it's really a jumping-off point. It makes our lives a lot easier when we are creating new dishes or when we are trying to put something on the menu last minute. We can pull from all these flavors that we've already created. And the technique section, while we were writing the book, would get really big and then kind of smaller, and we pulled out a lot of technique from that section, actually, because it was getting way too big, and also because they didn't relate necessarily to the recipes in the book. So we tried to whittle it down so that the techniques and the overarching themes that we talk about in that first section are things that are then useful for creating the recipes in the second section. With that said, most of the ingredients that we make in-house are mimicking things that you can buy.
Yeah, you
said
that.
So we hope that readers won't be completely discouraged by the intense cross-referencing that does happen in the book. And if they want to make something on a Wednesday night, they can go and buy yogurt. If they want to make it, great. But if they don't want to, it's not, it doesn't discount the ability to create those recipes and those dishes.
Talk to me about powders. Now, you said you could go buy them, and I'll tell you, I think the garlic powder is probably commercially produced. It's probably the most horrendous thing I've ever put in my mouth.
It can be a little bit cloying. Part of that is I think, I don't know what they add to it sometimes, but there are some higher-end ones right now in specialty stores and things like that that have become quite delicious. Like, I know that, Dean and DeLuca carries a garlic powder. I think even, like, Sur La Table does. So it doesn't have to be one that has been sitting on a shelf somewhere in an old grocery store for a while, but there are some better ones out there these days. And when in doubt, use something that you think is delicious or, you know, use fresh garlic if it's already a wet medium.
Right. But, I mean, you really value powders. I mean, you have powders for things that never even occurred to me.
We got powders for days in the restaurant.
Uh-huh. Exactly. How about burnt bread powder? That really was that was a surprise.
Oh, that one's delicious. We were just using it last night. We were making the burnt bread paste.
You burn the bread, right?
All the way black.
All the way black. And I can't remember the last time I've ever tasted burnt toast.
Actually, it's got this kind of sweet, bitter char going on, and the beauty of working with Chad Robertson's bread is he's already layered in so many flavors to begin with that by the time we get it and we burn it, we just get to add on to that.
You know,
and so it's a really fun collaboration working with his bread.
You've used this term a lot, as layering flavors. In fact, that's a popular term that's used in food writing today and in chefs' conversations today. Can you take an example of a dish and explain what you mean by layering flavors?
Sure. A good example of that is the sauerkraut stew, also known as kapusnica in Slovak.
It's right.
A Slovakian-style stew. And in the book that we, the recipe that we have there is kind of throw everything in one pot, you layer in the flavor, they're kind of, it's all happening at once. Sometimes when we make it at the restaurant, we'll layer it in a different way. And it doesn't mean that it tastes different. It just, it can have more levels to it. So that's a good one to kind of, we start with the broth and we add kombu seaweed to it. So we're adding umami. We're adding glutamates to it. There's times that we add katsuobushi to it. We're adding a gentle bit of smoke to it. It doesn't taste fishy. It just has a gentle aroma of smoke. So we're layering that in. So we have, like, chicken fat right now. We have the seaweed aroma. We have the katsuobushi. And then we start adding in pork fat and bacon fat. And then we add in mushrooms and paprika salami and onions. And so it's just kind of getting all these different flavors are building in there that you end up with, you know, you end up noticing the pork, the smoke, and sweet from the onions. And you notice all of these different flavors, but they kind of, they meld with each other, but they stand alone in there as well. So you'll taste one, and then the other one comes through. So that's one example of layering flavors. The other one is like the carrot and the burnt bread. So you have this kind of creamy sauce. It has a little bit of sour to it from the lime. You have this burnt bread that is charred, it's dark, it's deep, it's earthy. sweet carrots, but they have like a little bit of spice on them, and they do have a little bit of acid and honey. So all of these kind of nuanced flavors are in each level, but alone they're totally balanced, but together, hopefully, our goal is that they create this kind of this sense of density of flavor.
There's a good deal of what I think you might call good old Yankee ingenuity, except it's Eastern European ingenuity.
And I
want to use the tripe recipe as an example of that.
That stuck out to me too.
It's really funny. I had to read it 6 times to understand what you meant in the first column, because you said a lot of people's recipes for tripe involve cooking it for a long time, and we don't. We cook it 3 different ways. And then I read further across, and the first step is to cook the tripe for 4.5 hours.
Right.
So I'm wondering here, and then not satisfied with that, you take the tripe, and having cooked it for 4.5 hours, you then braise it, and then you fry it, it at the end.
Right, we grill it, and then we fry it. So, I mean, perhaps we need to clarify that even further in the book, which is, let's hear it for hopefully, you know, multiple printings, which will allow us to do that, is we don't just cook it so that it's soft and fall apart like...
It has texture,
Right, like tripe alla milanese or something like that. Yeah. We then try and take all of the texture that's on that tripe after it's been cooked and tenderized and all that, and almost like bring it back to the surface.
I got it. Okay, so you're returning it to a texture that's something other than mush. Now,
than just kind of soft.
I mean, I happen to like tripe.
I do too, especially for the texture.
Especially the way they cook it in Rome, because it's really delicious. But the texture is one of the downsides, and I think the texture is what puts a lot of people off.
Exactly. Lusciousness and then make it crispy again.
Yeah, my mother would never let it in the house. My stepfather really liked it, but we never had it in the house because
she didn't like it. Well, back to your larder. You cover so much ground. I just wanted to give listeners an idea of what all. I mean, in addition to drying, which is very extensive, making powders, you have a lot of Asian flavors and recipes for those things. You do a lot of drying and other things with fruits, in which you tend to use instead of regular sugar, which I love. I love that idea. I was intrigued by you have the meat and fish recipes, even making your own Botarga. You have an extensive dairy program, a sprouting and soaking, vinegar pickles, preserves. Talk to us a little bit about dashi. You seem to be really high on dashi.
We're pretty excited about dashi. It's this very simple broth with, like, nothing is simple about it.
Yeah, I love it.
It allows us to start a base for even the rhubarb soup dessert that's in there. We use dashi in that. So it's a flavor foundation for us, really. We're taking water, and we're just making the water more flavorful, and then allows us to just kind of start building. It's a building block. It's a very base layer building block for us.
Well, some wonderful things out of this larder. I think we should note that soups are one of your strong points, and you have very unusual soups such as black garlic and lentil, and your sauerkraut soup sounds like I want to eat it in 10 minutes from now.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Me too.
And then you have these wonderful salads that are meals themselves. And Peter talked a bit about, and you explained shared plates, which is your style of putting many dishes on the table. And also the sweets. I think that I appreciate your sweets philosophy, because I'm not crazy about dead sweet sugars.
Sure.
And also you have, I loved your humor in your harvest party, getting rid of that nasty rooster.
We met one of those guys once in Sicily.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the day that we made that rooster boil, we were fortunate enough to be able to be part of the actual slaughtering of the chickens, too. And I say fortunate in so much that full circle cooking is really important to us.
Right.
And so it was a pretty powerful day for us, because we did, from the minute we got there to our farmer's house, we were able to work with the animals, and then we pulled off all of their feathers, and then we were able to cook, brined them and cooked them, and just that whole process, and, you know, when we look through to that section of the book, there's a lot of meaning to that day for us.
You heard it here, listeners. You heard it right now. This book will change your life.
It's a life changer.
Because it will turn everything you think you know about ingredients and techniques and food upside down. If you read too much of it, as we are in danger of doing, you'll simply surrender and say,
We're going to have sour on the shelf in no time.
I'm going to live in the Republic of Tartinia. Thank you so much for joining us. Please say hello to Nick, and don't forget to tell him the goulash story.
I will. Thank you guys so much for having us. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Courtney, you did a great job, and I'm really impressed with this and anxious to taste your food.
Thank you.
All we need now is to get to San Francisco and tuck in. So
please,
we'll
come visit soon.
we'll do that soon.
Courtney,
okay,
thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Great
have
meeting
safe travels
you.
Over the holidays.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and now we're going to be talking to somebody who's been a friend and previously interviewed by us as well. She has wonderful restaurants, great pickles, and now a really, really wonderful cookbook, and it's Renee Erickson. Renee, it's hard to believe that this is your first cookbook. You have how many restaurants now?
I have three restaurants. I have three restaurants and one bar.
And a food truck.
And a food truck, yeah. I forgot about that, yeah. Food truck called Narwhal, which is really adorable.
Is that from down the rabbit hole, too?
No, Narwhal was, you know, we have a love for, well, obviously a kind of absurd love for sea creatures now, but there's the, I can't even remember the name of the movie, but there's a movie that has a narwhal in it, and it's a cartoon, and it's just adorable, and so we've always sort of joked about it being really charming and cute, so.
It sounded a little bit like Lewis's kind of name, actually.
Yeah. I mean, they're bizarre. They have that big, long, it's actually a tooth, which is what's so bizarre, and the males have the big, long tooth that comes out of their mouth. It's not actually, it looks sort of like it's a horn, but it's their tooth.
So it's sort of like a walrus the other way.
Yep, exactly. And yeah. Only one.
Well, before we forget, let's list the restaurants.
Sure. So my first restaurant is Boat Street Cafe.
Which is where we were,
Yep, exactly. That's 18 years I've owned it now, which is sort of hard to believe.
Ooh, that's really amazing.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah. Yes. And then Walrus Burger, which is the oyster bar. And then 2 years ago, we opened a restaurant called The Whale Wind, which is a restaurant where everything is wood oven, basically. So we cook all of our vegetables and our meats and seafood all in the wood oven and then prepare dishes from that. And then last year we opened a bar right next to Walrus called Barnacle. Barnacle's an Amaro bar. So it's a real simple, tiny space that has really great cocktails and drinks and food from Italy, basically.
But one of your partners already predicted you were going to own a place called the Barnacle, right?
Yeah, Jeremy did. Yeah.
Jeremy.
He wanted to open a bar named Barnacle.
Well, I want to say that this is your first cookbook. It's called A Boat, A Whale, and A Walrus, Menus and Stories. And I have to say that it seems to me that it is very much an expression of who you are. I feel like I know you through this book.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it became very personal, which I think in the beginning I wasn't sure that would be with the case. But as we started telling stories around the food, it became clear that it was, you know, really about lots of events in my life and people in my life that have been so influential. And by doing that, you know, really kind of telling a lot of personal stories and like love of my job and the people that I get to.
But, you know, there's first of all, I think the things you like are the things that I like, too. I mean, you really like savory things, don't you?
I sure do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's my preference, too. And you also like kind of a direct approach to things. Like, when you're talking about how to use this book, you just shoot from the hip on it. You're like cleaning mushrooms. Since mushrooms live in the forest where it rains, I'm not afraid to watch them. You know, people give you all this crazy advice about how, you know, they sell those stupid brushes, the mushroom brushes.
I know. I mean, it is funny because there, you know, people really do have a lot of opinions about that. And yet, it's one thing if you're buying mushrooms that are cultivated, you know, in a house where they cut them off and, you know, remove them perfectly from the dirt. But if they're rained on and pine needles are everywhere, you kind of got to get them out. You can't have all that chunked up dirt and pine needles in your sauce or whatever. So I think for me, the only way to get it out is to soak them, basically, and keep rinsing them so that you can pull out all the bits that you don't want.
Yeah, I mean, like morels.
Black trumpets are the worst.
I mean, you're close to morel territory. I mean, that's the perfect example.
Yeah.
You'd be eating grit if you didn't wash them.
Oh, yeah. Tons of sand. Yeah, it would not be delicious.
Well, now you hinted a little bit about the organization of the book and some of the things you have in it, but let's just lay it out for our listeners. You cook according to season, so that's how you've organized your book. But you varied it with something that's very popular today, is personal stories and also stories and profiles of the people you deal with, be they the fishing boat people or your staff or farmers, whatever. Which I thought was kind of cute, is you have that extra section after each of the seasons where you discuss the ingredients more.
Right.
Right.
Well, I felt like I was, you know, not... It was a way to be able to add more to the book as far as recipes without seeing them like giant full-blown recipes. Because it was free ingredient. There's 20 things you want to do with it, and you only get to pick one. It just seemed unfair. So we found a way to squeeze in a little bit more information, basically.
You also do whole meals and parties. My favorite party is your birthday.
Mine too. Oh, it's terrible.
I loved it.
Why don't you tell our listeners what you're laughing at?
Yeah. Tell us about your birthday. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been a big, my birthday's in August, so Seattle, it's the perfect month to be outside, and my family always threw big parties. We had this big lawn, or we would go to the beach or whatever and have these big, giant parties with family and friends, and it just became tradition that I would have this big party. So over the last, for sure, you know, 15 years or so, every year I throw a party for myself, and it's 40 or 50 people, and it's just, and typically it's very similar food because the type of party that it is, it's to feed a lot of people and to kind of have it be as simple as possible. But, you know, having all the most delicious summer ingredients and bean tomatoes, which is one of them, which is sort of one of my favorite summer
Me
dishes,
too.
Just super simple.
Yeah.
And just to not fuss over it, but just have like the best stuff done really simply so that you can enjoy everyone and hang out and drink rosé and celebrate. So it's become definitely a big tradition in my life and I think in my friend's life too, because we just all get together and have a really nice time and drink lots of wine and eat great food.
Yeah, what,
but, you know, it's a little funny, too, because I'm, you know, dedicating a whole chapter to my birthday.
Yeah,
so.
I have a friend who her birthday is not a day, it's a whole month. She takes the whole month.
Oh, yeah. We've started talking about how you get to celebrate as many days as you are years old.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Well, I don't think we could last that long.
I know. It'd be a party.
I love who we are. You really tell a lot about yourself in your restaurants in that section. I like this. In general, my restaurants are energetic but quiet. I think that's wonderful. I mean, that's a great image.
Yeah, I'm not somebody who is super fussy about food, fussy in my way, but not in a like kind of classic sense about food. You don't do a lot of tweezer food or anything like that. And so I want my food to reflect the kind of environment that I want, kind of more jovial and loud and vibrant versus serious, I guess, is a better way of describing it. And, you know, the restaurants tend to be like that as well, so where you can order a giant steak that serves three people and have a big, bold bottle of Chateau de Pop or something that is intended to be more celebratory than business meeting. And all of that happens in all my restaurants, but I try to create an environment where people will come to, not just to celebrate events, but to also leave work and want to go have a cocktail and hang out with their friends. And I think the environment of restaurants can kind of lend to different sort of purposes, and I want mine to be vibrant and lively and loud and exciting. And
yeah, well, we love, the only one we've been to is the Boat Street Cafe. I don't know if we even mentioned that all of your restaurants are in Seattle. I guess we ought to mention that.
Yeah.
But we had a great time. We had lunch with your friend who was actually the owner of the original Boat Street Cafe, right?
Yes, Susan, yeah.
Susan, and we had a great time. And she steered us around the menu. I love the whimsy that's involved with your restaurants, like the illustration. And you have you have an illustrator that does that.
Yeah, so my actual education is in...
You studied art, and it's very evident, I think. Yeah,
exactly. So my education is in art, and so having creative people in my life and people that I can ask for creative inspiration for the restaurants is so special to me, and I think so lucky to have that, to have friend Jeffrey Mitchell, who did the cover of the book, to send me drawings from Colorado that we then framed and put in the Carpenter. So, some of it just sort of happened out of knowing him and having conversations, and then in the book is something that we directly asked him to do, but a lot of it just sort of is just kind of the people that I get to hang out with, and they bring this great, clever and funny way of decorating the restaurants in a way that I think if I were to do it all on my own, it would be impossible to make it so charming and funny and full of texture and interesting experiences that you can only get from a collection of people and a collection of ideas.
Yeah, no, I was very happy to find your, not that I'll ever make them, but I was happy to find your pickle recipes because we just fell in love with your pickle. You pickle fruit as well as vegetables.
Right.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. But what was my favorite one? Was it the fig or was it raisins? I can't remember now. But they're wonderful, your pickles. Each restaurant is different, though, right?
They are. They're all different. So Boat Street's the most classic. It's French-inspired, more rustic country French than a more formal setting. And then Walrus and the Carpenter is an oyster bar that predominantly serves seafood, a lot of raw seafood, and smoked and cured as well. And
I like that.
No problem.
You kind of show us an illustration. How we're supposed to make a smokehouse. I don't think we're going to do that in Center City, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that smoker is amazing.
Yeah.
And then Whalewinds is kind of more inspired from Middle East and England and Italy. And so we kind of take kind of our favorite things and spices and ways of cooking and do it in our own way. But by cooking everything in the wood oven as well, you sort of add this really kind of rustic and smoky texture to the food. And then, Barnacle is the Amaro Bar, which is actually one of my favorite places.
I love Amaro.
Super charming. I do too. We have,
there you go, bitter
now.
You're salty and bitter, right? And
totally.
The other thing is, you and I agree that room temperature food is great. I grew up with the Italian tradition of putting stuff out at room temperature.
Yeah, it's funny when you think about eating at home. You don't, or at least I don't, unless I'm cooking soup or something that's particular. It's fine to let the chicken sit out and wait for a side dish to be ready, and you're not going to fret about it. And really, I think it is better a lot of times. Those flavors are not overwhelmed by heat or cold. And I think people really worry about something that really isn't that important.
Well,
by making something hot all the time.
I'm totally jealous though about your resources for sourcing food product. You have this whole spread on crab, but we don't get Dungeness crab here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost hard to go wrong with the kind of product you have.
It's true. I think to be a cook here in the Northwest is pretty spectacular, and we get such a great variety of being by the sea and also by the mountains. And yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, I think maybe the only other place that I would maybe be a little bit envious of is Northern California, where you can get all the citrus. But other than that, like, there's nothing missing from our collection of ingredients that we get to work with. It's fantastic.
You do marrow bones. You should check our website, because there's a picture of Peter at this restaurant in Italy near Padua. He ordered a marrow bone, and it came out looking like, I say, it's, he's impersonating or channeling Fred Flintstone. It looks like a dinosaur bone.
Yeah, it's a complete veal shank, the whole thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Now, it's really kind of disappointing because there's not all that much marrow in it. But imagine they take a veal shank and they run a bone saw right down the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get half of it, and I'm holding it and trying not to make too much of a mess.
It's on our website under OTM and pictures. You should go look at it. It's really pretty funny.
I will.
It's funny. So anyhow, and all your good buddies came through and endorsing your book. Chris Hersheimer and Melissa Hamilton, they're spectacular too.
Aren't they great?
Oh, yeah. And Molly and Kathy Wims. We love Kathy. So, yeah, well, congratulations on this book. And I think that it's a whole experience. And I think our listeners really will enjoy this. And I can't wait to get back to Seattle to go try some of your others.
I know. Yeah, well, you'll come back and we can cook you some crab. We've been roasting in the oven at the Whalewinds, and it's so fabulous.
Oh, wow. Last time we were there, we had Taylor Shellfish. What's the name of the place that was the outlet?
Well, I think they own it, don't they?
Yeah,
They have a place in like a little mini shopping mall.
Yeah, up on Capitol Hill at the Melrose Market.
That's it. Demolished 6 dozen oysters between the three of us.
Yeah,
awesome. I love it.
We'll come to Walrus and Carpenter and eat all your profits.
I love it. Yeah. It's so good. Come soon.
Renee, thank you for taking the time in your busy schedule for this.
And, of course, my pleasure.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see you soon.
Yeah, well, hopefully you guys come back out soon, or otherwise I'll look you up when I'm back there.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Renee.
Have a great day.
Ciao.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, sweetheart, who's up in the final segment?
Yeah, well, again, another long-time acquaintance, and I'm always very excited when Karen Page announces a new book coming out, because she doesn't just write a book. She writes another absolutely essential encyclopedia. It's called a Bible, but it's the a vegetarian, too, which is right on the mark time-wise, and she always has so many great, brilliant insights. Let's listen to Karen. I must be one of millions who totally adore Karen Page's book and Andrew Dornberg's. Well, I'm looking now at his photographs, which I had never seen before, and the interesting history where his grandmother had her own dark room and equipment.
Yes.
That's amazing. I never knew that about your husband.
You know, he's a man of many talents, and even though we've been together for almost 3 decades, I keep learning new capabilities that I never knew he had, and certainly the four-color photography for the Vegetarian Flavor Bible was one of them.
It's gorgeous. So that's the book we're going to be talking about, and as I said to you before we came on air, now we've been reading your book since, when was the first one published?
If you can think back to 1995, okay. That was actually when Becoming a Chef debuted.
Okay, and at one point, I mean, they've always been fine books, but at one point there was a turn to you were producing absolutely required reading classics that are going to have the longest shelf life going. And this one joins the ranks of those classics, the Vegetarian Flavor Bible. Reading this book, I think anyone will sense that this was a major experience in your life as well, because it modified how you approach food, and you've been approaching food for quite a long time.
Well, absolutely. I have been at it, I guess, since Becoming a Chef came out, which we just determined was 1995. So we signed our first book contract in 1992, so literally working on books for the last couple of decades. And yes, it was really a huge turning point for me. Life throws things in your path and takes you down in the direction of journeys that you never thought you would be on. It's been really eye-opening for me to have been eating without meat very happily, very healthfully for the last 2.5 years. It was in May of 2012 that Andrew and I decided to go on this experiment and to leave meat off of our plates and out of our diets. And that came on the heels of losing 4 parents to cancer over a 10-year period and really no longer being able to ignore the headlines that there is a correlation between nutrition and wellness, and that we might want to, for the first time in our lives, think about what we put in our bodies when we weren't out at top restaurants talking with chefs eating professionally.
Well, of course, many times the nutrition in the news gives mixed messages, but I think that the way everyone's reacting in terms of personal choices for diet today indicates that it's weighing much more heavily towards plant-based diets now.
You're absolutely right. In fact, it's the majority of Americans today, 54%, who are actually eliminating or reducing meat from their diet. And that's one of the reasons that for the past 5 years, we've seen for the first time in American history a decline in annual per capita consumption of meat, and additional declines are forecast for the foreseeable future, because I think the health correlations are no longer able to be poo-pooed. The science is there. We've proven that a plant-based diet is best. That is the one thing that nutritional experts will agree upon. And I think beyond that, there's hosts of other reasons. If you look at the college-age population, I think as many as 18 to 20% of college students are either vegetarian or vegan, and a lot of them are coming at it from the animal rights perspective. I think a number of people, older people who are concerned about the planet we're leaving behind for those college students, are concerned about the environmental factors that come into play when you're looking at big animal agriculture and the impact that it has on the planet. So there's a whole host of reasons that together are really contributing to the fact that we're eating less meat than ever before here in the United States.
Karen, as always, your books are so thoroughly researched. You've got degrees from Harvard, and that you just got a certificate from which institute?
I went back to school and earned a certificate in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University in conjunction with the T. Colin Campbell Foundation.
Right. But I'm not surprised that everything you do is thorough, but this one is really off the wall thorough.
I had a lot to learn, so I set out to learn it and to share everything that I'd learned, which was so eye-opening, in the Vegetarian Flavor Bible.
Now, for those people, Ken, for those people who don't even know that the original Flavor Bible exists, or certainly haven't read it, there was something about it that was really landmark. Not just that it was a great book, but because it filled such a need by answering questions like, if I don't have this, what can I use instead? And chefs swore by that and kept it by their bedside or by their stove in order to be able to respond to just that situation if they couldn't get just this particular ingredient. Now, did you do the same with the Vegetarian Flavor Bible?
We did. It was based on and modeled after the successful format of the Flavor Bible itself, which I think clocks in at about just under 400 pages. And the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, instead of just taking out the meat from the book, it's actually 50% longer than the Flavor Bible itself, because once you take meat out of the equation, all the other plant-based ingredients, the vegetables, the legumes, the mushrooms, and everything else takes on so much more importance that we go into those ingredients so much more thoroughly in the book. And so, yes, it's a similar format. There's some improvements that were made because we learned some things in the 6 years since the Flavor Bible itself was published. A lot of people found the book, it's so comprehensive and so encyclopedic, it's a little hard to maneuver. So we've added colored tabs on the right-hand side so you can easily skim any ingredient from A to Z, apples to zucchini blossoms, and find exactly what you're looking for. And then there's actually a beautiful green bookmark that will help you keep your place in that 600-page book so you can go back to whatever it is you need.
I like, because a lot of people have questions about vegetarian eating and vegan eating in particular. I like how you have a quote from somebody with a position, for example, on how much protein you should eat. And then you give another reference from somebody else. And then you say, what I do. I love that.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, it can get a little dry when you're just quoting doctors and you're quoting the government reports. And so sometimes it's helpful to bring it to life in terms of, okay, here's where I come down. Because not all the doctors and not all the government reports agree. And protein is one of those things. If you go to the My Plate on the government's website, you'll see that they're still recommending section of protein. Actually, it used to be called meat. Now it's called protein. So there's an acknowledgement that you can have a healthy diet just based on plants. And if you choose to substitute legumes or tofu or some other major protein source, that you can certainly do that. But there's a glass of milk on that plate. And it doesn't even take into account the fact that 75% of the world's population is thought to be lactose intolerant.
And so are you.
If I ever tried to eat the daily allotment of dairy, I would be incredibly
sick.
You'd
be bent over double.
Right. So we all need to figure out for ourselves what should we eat to be healthy? What can we eat to be healthy? And I think it takes a lot of research and a lot of thought, but each of us needs to make those decisions for ourselves.
I personally don't understand why adults are supposed to be drinking milk anyhow, to tell you the truth, I think.
Well, I mean, human beings are the only species that drinks another species' milk. It's kind of crazy when you think about it, but because it's so indoctrinated in our culture, a lot of us don't tend to ask those questions. But when those facts are pointed out to us, it's like, well, gee, no wonder. Is it crazy that I should drink this something that makes me ill and then have to take a pill, like a lactate, to digest it? It's like, why don't I just take it out of my diet? I don't know if you've tried some of the vegan ice creams out there, but a lot of them don't even like to call themselves vegan ice creams. They call them nut-based ice creams because basically they're so delicious that they can compete with any other ice cream on the basis of flavor alone. And so they're afraid that if they put the V word, vegan, in front of them, that some people will be turned off because a lot of people don't know what those terms mean, really. And they think there's something extra added. It's like, no, there's nothing extra added. There's a lot taken out. There's dairy taken out. And what's put in is, some cases, with the nut-based ice creams, it's just nut milk and lots of great natural flavors, and they're really incredible. And I think based on the texture, the flavor, it could be satisfying to any ice cream lover.
Now, let's make sure we understand your definition of vegetarian for the purposes of the book. Does that include dairy? Does that include eggs? Does that include some of the other things which are sort of on the border?
Well, when I use the term vegetarian, I think it's generally thought to refer to a diet that eliminates all meat. So meat, red meat, white meat, as well as seafood. So no fish, no shellfish either. And when we're talking about vegan, that is as restrictive as vegetarian, but it takes it a step further and also restricts eggs, also restricts dairy, and in
honey.
Many cases, animal-derived products such as honey or gelatin.
Uh-huh. I had to do a Thanksgiving dinner for my vegan cousin. That was really, I had to read all the labels. I never realized what went into half the stuff.
I thought I had a smart idea. I thought, I'll go to the index to find out what the alternative is to pizza. But it wasn't there, Karen.
Well, we do have a section on Thanksgiving, so you can look up some ideas for a vegan Thanksgiving. And really, I think for me personally, it's always about the stuffing and the mushroom gravy, which is exactly what I had to celebrate for Thanksgiving this year, along with all the other side dishes and accompaniments on the table. Last year, we tried a vegan celebration roast that's made by a company called Feel Roast, and it's a grain-based sort of center of the
Thanksgiving holiday table sort of dish. But we were so enthusiastic about it last year that it completely sold out in New York. And we take a little bit of the blame for that because we told a lot of people about it. But this year we found that we didn't even need one in the center of our plate. We were so happy with the stuffings. And we had a potluck with friends and everybody brought different dishes. And it was quite lovely.
I guess I should insert here that as a result of this, you actually feel healthier and you've lost weight.
I have.
How much weight did you lose?
Well, Andrew and I have both lost north of 20 to 25 pounds. And it's so funny because when you write about food, when you're involved in the food world, I think overeating can be a regular challenge that many of us deal
Tell me
with.
About
but
it.
What I found was that when I stopped eating meat, and certainly when I cut back on dairy and eggs as well, that the weight just sort of fell off and my weight normalized for the first time in my adult life. And I was quite amazed by it because I actually eat more in quantity than I ever have before. But the fact is that plant-based ingredients are lower in calories and higher in nutrients than other foods. So I'm finding that I really can eat a lot more, and yet the net result is that I keep losing weight. Actually, now I'm just healthfully maintaining my weight.
Unless you do what a lot of vegetarians do, which is they turn to really crude carbs, I mean, tons of white carbs and stuff, which is...
Yeah, I mean, eating vegetarian does not necessarily equate with eating healthy, and you really
right.
do need to think about both of those aspects of things. And I've seen overweight vegans, and a lot of them are junk food vegans. Soy burger, French fries, and a Coke
right.
is technically vegan, but I don't think anybody's going to argue that it's a healthy diet.
You tackle the history of vegetarianism in this book. And I did that for some article a long time ago, but I never got back as far as you did. You start with 3000 to 2000 BCE. I mean, I didn't realize.
It's funny. I certainly didn't myself, and I have to admit that I didn't start there. Where I started was I thought, well, you know, I should put something in about the history of vegetarian cuisine, go back to the 60s, and find out where all that brown rice and sprouts came from. And the more I started researching the history of vegetarianism, obviously the further back it took me down a lot of fascinating paths, and it's a little hard to stop. So I could have gone on and on, but I thought I would just start with, say, 2000 to 3000 BC with the founding of the Hindu religion and the fact that there was this teaching that human beings should not inflict pain on other animals,
right.
which is what led people to the compassionate practice of vegetarianism.
They've considered the lobster and have never been comfortable about cooking lobster since. Do you remember that?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes.
The other interesting thing you do is you list cravings and what you can substitute for them. I thought that was fascinating too.
Well, you know, I have always written the books that we needed to read. We wrote our first book, Becoming a Chef, when Andrew was trying to decide if he should go to cooking school or what he should do to become a chef, and that was what led us down that path to write that book. With this book, we were looking for the answers. How can we be happy vegetarians or vegans? And I have to say, as a girl from the Midwest, I grew up eating meat three times a day. A meal wasn't a meal unless it included meat. And since childhood, bacon has been one of my top five ingredients that I've thought, if I ever had to stop eating, I would cease to exist. So I never lost my craving for that smoky flavor, for that crispy flavor and texture, or that richness. And what I found was that there are other ways in a vegetarian or a vegan diet that I can satisfy those cravings that have nothing to do with consuming animal protein. So, for example, Andrew's, one of his great holiday dishes is a split pea soup that his mom used to make with the leftover bone from the holiday ham.
Right.
And we both thought that we were really going to miss that dish, but what we found was that we took out the ham bone and we put in instead a healthy accent of smoked paprika, and that we loved the soup just as much, if not more. That there is a beautiful depth of flavor there that we're just as satisfied with.
Now, if you're missing bacon, have you ever run across the people at J&D Enterprises? I think they're in Seattle. Their first product was bacon salt.
Mm.
And it's totally kosher.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that one of the parents of J.O.D., I forget which it is, he's a food scientist. So they had this crazy idea that wouldn't it be great if people who were kosher could still eat and enjoy the flavor of bacon. So they had their father concoct a set of chemicals which tastes like and smell like bacon.
But I don't think that's very healthy. Like. I mean, I'm really not a fan of faux meat. I don't like it at all. I mean, we have a restaurant in town that made things that look like something else. You know what I mean?
But if the alternative is pining for wonderful white shiny stuff.
But it's probably all chemicals, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. It's interesting because where we've come down on it is we found a lot of the vegan processed meats to be very useful transitional ingredients. And so I was very happy to discover the field roast, the celebration roast that I mentioned. They also do these grain-based sausages that are flavored either as chorizo or with a more traditional Italian flavor that are great to crumble up and throw into pastas or onto pizzas. And I love having those available. I use them a lot more when I first started this process back in May of 2012 than I do today because I've found that I've really evolved much more toward wanting to eat whole foods as opposed to processed foods. But still, when I have a craving, I love knowing that they're around. When I've run into people who have been looking to reduce or eliminate meat from their diet, it's one of the products that I refer people to. And I think it can be a wonderful, very helpful crutch when you're looking to make major changes in your life and you're trying to get used to those things. But in terms of, I agree with you that I do try to avoid a lot of the meat substitutes, but we have a wonderful New York Times 2-star restaurant in New York City called Kijitsu, which serves the cuisine that's been developed over the centuries by monks, essentially. And they have really perfected, I think, over the centuries, some of the meat substitutes. And so you can find some very good versions of them, even in New York City's Chinatown at Mewa. They've got some very convincing versions that sometimes make us put our forks down because they're a little too convincing.
You know, we just got a product sample in the mail called the Aroma Fork. And so I was really interested in reading the section you have on the components of flavor. Do you know about this thing?
I don't know about the Aroma Fork. What is it?
What you do is it comes in a set, and you have the forks, and you have the liquid aromas, all sorts of, there are 50 different aromas, and you have little absorbent pads, and you put real food on the one part of the fork, you know, the regular part of the tines, and then you put one of these saturated aroma pads, and then as you bring it to your mouth and you inhale and you get the flavor hits the aroma hits the back of your throat and it alters what goes into the taste buds in the front of your tongue.
I'll have to read up on that a little bit.
It's interesting.
I don't understand why it's such a good idea.
I don't know either, but
so what will they think of next?
Right. Now, let's move on to the bulk of this book, which is where you actually have alphabetically arranged ingredients and suggestions on pairings and how to prepare them, right?
Exactly.
And now, I was curious. Well, you must have eaten a whole lot of different vegetables, right?
Absolutely.
Was there anything you were particularly surprised about?
So funny because it's such a great question, and I am always looking for what surprises me. And so I've gotten to the point where so little surprises me anymore because it's like, oh, yes, of course so-and-so is doing that. Of course, ingredient that I didn't know anything about existed. I think one of the biggest surprises, though, overall with the research for this book was that I have never felt a sense of deprivation from not eating meat. And it's funny because a lot of our chef friends will look at us and they'll say, so, you know, the book is out, you finished your research, you know, when are you coming back? Yeah. And I think they're surprised to hear that it's agreed with us both so much. I mean, the feeling better, you know, I have so much better physical feeling, you know, which leads to better emotional feeling, mental clarity. You know, there's so many reasons that this diet and way of living agrees with me so much that it's, you know, why would I want to give that up? So I think the biggest surprise is that of what really what you can learn about flavor when you experiment with your diet. And I think for anyone who this isn't something for me, I would really encourage people to try it just as an exercise. Like if you really care about food and flavor, you want to learn more about food and flavor, give up meat for a certain amount of time. You know, some people suggest, you know, a week, 21 days, whatever period of time you want to give it a shot, and just to see how your body feels. Do it as an experiment to see how it feels. Pay attention to your palate and how much more vivid the flavors become. When you eliminate meat and dairy from the dishes that you're eating, I think the other flavors become so much more alive. And in fact, I think that's one of the biggest surprises is the fact that a lot of chefs are creating dishes that are vegetarian and vegan, all in the name of flavor, that they're looking to intensify the flavor of things like soups. We talked to Terrence Brennan, who has the 3-star restaurant Picheline in New York City. He talked about the process of perfecting his winter squash soup, and in doing so, he realized, well, I was using chicken stock, so instead he started using veg stock, eventually moved to a squash stock. He had been putting cream in it, and he realized all that the cream was doing was diluting the flavor, so he took the cream out. So by substituting a squash stock and taking out the cream, he inadvertently ended up making it a vegan soup, all in the name of better flavor. And I think he really does have one of the best winter squash soups in America. So I think there's example after example of chefs who are evolving their cuisine in that direction simply in the name of flavor. And I think that that's true for consumers as well. You go out to restaurants, you take the meat and you take the dairy out of the things that you're ordering, and it will enhance the flavor also.
Well, you're hitting on something that I was going to mention anyhow. Probably 10 years ago, you couldn't have written this book.
Jean-Georges came out with his book, Simple Cuisine.
Yes,
that's
true. I think
it was in the 1990s. I'm not sure the exact year, early 1990s. And I think it was almost a little ahead of his time. What he was doing was taking out meat stock, veal stock from his dishes and substituting juices and broths and really lightening things up and enhancing their flavor with vegetables. And I think that book was a big landmark book. I think it didn't catch on to the degree that you're seeing things catch on today because nutritional science wasn't what it is today. So that people, I think, are very convinced and persuaded from a health perspective that they need to move in a more plant-centric direction. And so that book was a little ahead of itself. I think it might even be out of print. I think if anybody sees a copy, they should grab it. And I think they should absolutely bring it back into print because he talks about how to use things like mushroom stock and to reduce it so that it has a texture and almost the flavor of a demi-glaze, but in a way that's so much more delicious, so much more healthful for you.
Yeah, I meant, though, you would not have as many different chefs and restaurants to actually choose from. I mean,
absolutely true, too. Right. There have been so many more vegetarian, vegan restaurants that have come on the scene since then, as well as restaurants that are offering vegetarian and vegan tasting menus, everything from 11 Madison Park to the Inn at Little Washington to Danielle to Per Se and the French Laundry. Yeah. It's a whole different scene today.
Well, now, when you were on this book tour, I just wanted to ask you, did you talk to a lot of people who seem like they're on the verge of taking you up on this proposal to eliminate meat from their diet?
I was pretty amazed because we had a broad range of people attending our events on a book tour from 20-somethings who are young, aspiring chefs who might have been cooking with the Flavor Bible and came out to see what this new book was all about, who really, you know, when you're in your 20s, you're indestructible, right? You don't care about health concerns. You care about flavor. You care about cuisine. And we had, you know, the 70-plus, 80-plus crowd who's looking to prevent or reverse heart disease, who's really concerned with eliminating meat and, in cases, oil as well, and certainly dairy products from their diets, and everything in between. So it was a really broad range of people who they themselves had an interest in the topic or they had friends or relatives who were vegetarian or vegan or had other health concerns that they were looking to change their diet. So I think that this is definitely on the upswing. I think that the next generation of professional chefs is really going to be creating a whole new cuisine that's going to be better for individuals' health and better for the planet, as well as incredibly satisfyingly delicious. And I can't wait to see some of the creations they're going to come up with through using the book.
Well, you are to be congratulated, as always, and I wish you much success. Again, it's the Vegetarian Flavor Bible by Karen Page with wonderful four-color photographs by her husband, Chef Andrew Dornenberg. And I may even try it. Karen, I'll let you know.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
And you,
both.
Too, Karen. Thank you.
We just recorded one ending, but Anne wasn't paying attention, so we're going to do it all over again. We hope you'll listen to us again, same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.